leaders in Wisconsin's capital are clashing, and we're talking about it here on The Morning Show. Wisconsin lawmakers are speaking up on gun policy, and the facts don't always line up with their points. It's The Morning Show on the State Capitol Report, and I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Republicans rejected Governor Tony Evers' call to take up legislation addressing gun violence. We'll get the details from our State Capitol reporter ahead, but first we're fact-checking elected officials who are weighing in on this gun debate. And you're part of the discussion. Have you heard an inaccurate claim during gun policy debates? What was it? And how did you figure out the statement was wrong? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Litke is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. Eric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we'll take specific claims about gun policy as we move ahead. Let's first talk about a statement that criticizes the renewed focus on guns. Back in August, after the mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio and El Paso, Texas, Wisconsin State Representative Ron Tussler posted on Facebook that mass shootings were down under President Trump. Eric, what did you learn while researching the number of mass shootings over time?
So this came immediately in the aftermath of these back-to-back shootings. There was the El Paso Walmart shooting on August 3rd, the Dayton, Ohio shooting August 4th. Later on August 4th, Tussler's post on Facebook was, "Less mass shootings under Trump. His base doesn't hate anyone." That text was accompanied by a reposting of a chart shared by another person, so we're kind of a third-generation chart here, showing 24 mass shootings under President Barack Obama and 4 under President Trump. Now, we see the chart was really the primary problem where this went awry here. So the data that it references is badly outdated. It came from a 2018 article in National Affairs, and that article itself was pulling from an LA Times story. The LA Times, however, was not presenting a comprehensive timeline of mass shootings. They are basically highlighting what they called notable mass shootings. So we have the core issue is that we're using kind of a summary of significant mass shootings to draw a comprehensive conclusion about how many shootings there have been.
And then there's also the issue of the numbers themselves, right? I mean, we have 2 years of President Trump. We have 8 years under President Obama. So if mass shootings are a problem, it would reason that we would have seen more under President Obama's tenure than Trump simply because of the number of years.
Absolutely. It's nonsense to use a round numbers comparison when you're talking about 8 years under Obama as compared to about 2 years under Trump at that point. So what we did is we looked at a rate stat. So converting this to the number of mass shootings that happened in each year. Mass shootings are kind of a tricky definition, but we went with what the Washington Post uses for their pretty comprehensive database, which is 4 or more people shot and killed in a single incident, not counting something like gang violence. And we can see there a steady rise over time, regardless of which party is in power. We could see about 2 mass shootings per year under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush, about 3.5 per year under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. That then jumps to about 5 mass shootings per year under Obama, about 8 under Trump. So ultimately, what we see is exactly the opposite of what Representative Tussler claims, which is that the shootings are indeed up under Trump as they have been under each of his recent predecessors.
And you rated this claim of Representative Tussler pants on fire. For listeners who aren't familiar with PolitiFact's rating system, help us understand how you come to a pants on fire rating. That's the least truthful. Is that an appropriate way to explain it?
Sure. So we have a scale that goes anywhere from true and then mostly true, half true, mostly false. And pants on fire is what we describe as completely false, but also ridiculous. This certainly reaches into that category, not only with the timing of it, but the outdated data, and then ultimately being the polar opposite of where indeed this trend is going.
How did Representative Tussler respond to your analysis?
So his response was basically that he was not aware that the chart he was posting was that outdated. He said he used raw numbers because they at least can't be twisted or biased. And it was an ironic response, of course, given that in this case, raw numbers certainly are biased, comparing a full 2 years under Obama to a half a term under Trump.
Eric Liedtke is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to hear from you. How do you respond when someone makes an inaccurate claim while debating public policy? Do you correct them? Do you let it slide? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's move on to a couple of statements by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss during a Facebook Live interview with TMJ4's Charles Benson. You analyzed part of their discussion about so-called red flag laws.
Red flag laws, it's basically like saying we're going to take away your car because we think you could drive drunk.
But a judge has to decide.
No, they take away your weapon first. Then you have to go back and ask for permission to get the weapon back.
That was Voss describing red flag laws, and Benson jumping in. Voss later made the same point while criticizing a poll that found broad support for red flag laws when a judge is involved.
The way they ask that question,
That's
not the way the red flag law works. They take it away first. Then you have to get permission from a judge to do it.
So, Eric, what did you find when researching whether red flag laws allow guns to be taken away from people before a judge is involved?
So red flag laws have been around for a while. They date back to Connecticut in 1990. As of now, about 17 states, as well as the District of Columbia, have a so-called red flag law, commonly called emergency risk protection orders. But typically, they do not work, as Voss describes. A judge is absolutely fundamental to this process. What we typically see is that there is an allowance in state statute for police or family members, or in some cases a school official or a mental health professional, to come before a judge and say, here's the case, why I believe this person is an imminent risk to themselves or others. The judge can then issue a preliminary order without any kind of a hearing and or without any notification to the gun owner. So then anywhere from 2 to 21 days, that hearing is in effect, the guns can be taken, and then there is a hearing on a final order where the gun owner has a chance to come before the judge and make his case before there would be something more long-term issued. A final order would typically last for about a year. But the key difference here is that the judge is involved from the get-go. And this includes the proposal that Governor Evers brought forward as he was pushing for a special session in Wisconsin. That would have created this preliminary order that lasts about 14 days. But again, nothing can be done without a judge being involved from the start.
You gave a mostly false rating to Representative Voss for those red flag law claims. How did you land on that rating?
So mostly false is a statement that is generally inaccurate, but has kind of an element of truth. The element of truth in this case is that Indiana is the one state in the country that does have something roughly like what he describes. Police there are able to seize firearms without first obtaining a judicial order. They are then required to immediately make a statement to a judge who can then overturn that initial decision. So there's an immediate judicial review involved, but there is essentially the ability to seize guns without a judge's immediate involvement. So that is certainly the exception and not the rule. Out of the 17 states that have a law in this vein, it's the only one that allows something like that. So given that that is the exception and that's not the proposal that was being brought forth in Wisconsin, we landed on a mostly false for the representative.
Eric Liedtke stays with us. He's a reporter for PolitiFact Wisconsin and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about whether what politicians are saying about gun control is based in truth. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. How much weight do you place in lawmakers' statements and their campaign promises when voting? Have you ever voted against a candidate because they didn't follow through on a pledge? Give us a call. I'm Keely Boltina. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about claims Wisconsin leaders are making as they wrestle with the policy and politics of gun control. Our guest takes pains to rate what's said as true, mostly true, half true, mostly false, false, or pants on fire. And you're part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. What question do you have about red flag gun laws? What do you want to know about universal background checks? Have you heard a politician say something about gun control and think, wait, is that right? Tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. PolitiFact Wisconsin and Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Eric Litke is our guest. He's checking the accuracy of state leaders, and we're focusing on conversations about guns. Governor Tony Evers and other Democrats are urging red flag laws and universal background checks. Two statements here on universal background checks we have, starting with a claim by Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald.
On universal background checks, too, I mean, anytime you're going to ask somebody to submit the serial numbers from their guns to a state or federal official, it's going to violate the Second Amendment. So I just don't see anything happening on that front as well.
That was Fitzgerald advocating against universal background checks during a September interview with WSIN. Eric, do gun background checks involve submitting serial numbers to authorities?
So this is a common argument that we hear from opponents of universal background checks, basically saying that any kind of a background check to this degree can be tantamount to a gun registry, where the government has a record of which gun each person owns. It's seen as basically a step towards confiscation. So the two elements of this claim we need to check out are, yes, are serial numbers submitted to state or federal officials during the process? And then does that violate the Second Amendment? So right now, Wisconsin is one of 29 states that do not require background checks for private gun sales. So there's a split for sales from like a registered gun dealer. Those are overseen by the ATF, required under federal law that a background check takes place. However, an exchange between private parties, there is nothing like that in current state law. So the universal background check would extend to that. So diving into this claim, the question basically becomes what information is submitted. So in Wisconsin, if someone is purchasing a long gun, the dealers fill out it's called the ATF Form 4473, that includes the gun make and the serial number. That is then sent through the FBI's criminal background check system. However, there are a series of kind of safeguards in place from the federal government side to make sure that these don't turn into a registry of some sort. So the information that is received for this background check, the FBI is required by law to destroy the identifying information on the purchaser and on the gun within 24 hours. The second piece of this is that the dealer is then required to keep a copy of this form for at least 20 years or until they go out of business. After that point, those records go to the ATF so that they are stored long term. However, the ATF is expressly forbidden from retaining these in any kind of searchable format or to establish any kind of registration system. So it's actually kind of an interesting background. They have to go through decades-old microfilm technology when they're trying to trace a gun now, for example. That's the process for long guns. For handguns, it's pretty similar. The same form is filled out, but the State Department of Justice is responsible for the background check. So we see that basically if there was a comprehensive system that ultimately this information would make it to the federal government eventually. But there's a significant delay in making it to the ATF. In the case of this form, it could be 20 years or longer before the ATF gets it. And at that point, the ATF is still required or prohibited from turning that into any kind of a database, which is really kind of the core of what Fitzgerald was concerned about there.
Yeah. And, you know, what stands out to me is that he also cited the Second Amendment, and that can be kind of a flashpoint for some people. So what have the courts ruled on this? Is something like this, universal background check, something that is violating the Second Amendment of our Constitution?
So universal background checks are not creating gun registries. The argument is that they could, and therefore that would violate it. Well, it's interesting to note that there are six states and the District of Columbia that actually do require that step of registration of some or all firearms, and those have been upheld by the courts. Many of those state laws have been in place for decades, None have been overturned on the grounds that they violate any individual's Second Amendment.
You also examined a claim on background checks from State Attorney General Josh Call. In an August tweet, the Attorney General claimed people convicted of a dangerous felony and people under a domestic violence restraining order, these people can currently buy firearms without background checks. Is that a true claim?
It is. So there was a bit of confusion on this, judging by some of the reaction online. It's, of course, not saying whether someone should buy a firearm without going through a background check, simply whether that is possible under the current system. As we kind of discussed with the Fitzgerald item, we have this two-pronged system where any purchase from a federal firearms dealer, so we're talking about something that takes place at a traditional a retail type of establishment, background checks are required there. But for a purchase between private parties, Wisconsin is one of the states that does not have any kind of requirement there. So most guns are purchased through dealers. A 2015 study found only about 22% of gun owners bought their most recent firearm without going through a background check. Nevertheless, Wisconsin is one of 29 states at this point that does not have any state-level regulations. So one of the places that we see this popping up is a website called Arms List. It's a Craigslist-style marketplace that connects private sellers and is very heavily used. We wrote this item in September 2019. At that point, there were about 2,000 firearms for sale from private parties in Wisconsin alone.
Eric Lipke is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about how Eric is fact-checking the statements that politicians and officials in Wisconsin are saying around gun policy. And I want to welcome Kevin from Dodgeville to the conversation now. Kevin, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me. And I'd like to say your speaker is a fantastic expert on this subject. I'm of the opinion that most common sense thinking people are in favor of background checks. I think that's necessary in the time that we live in. I am not in favor of anyone buying a gun without a background check. I think it's a loophole that needs to be closed. I am concerned with another aspect of this, and that's the inheritance aspect of inheriting weapons and things like that, coming to weapons without a legal purchase. How exactly does that work?
Kevin, thanks so much for the call. And Eric, it's a little off of what we're saying to try to explore that. Did you want to address whether you're fact checking anything when it comes to beyond these statements with background checks and red flag laws when it comes to guns? Maybe something about inheritance.
Unfortunately, I'm not going to be much help on that particular one. Not something that we have researched in terms of what the current laws are, or what changes might be sought right now,
or what politicians are really talking about right now. Eric, how do you find people respond when you fact check lawmakers? What did the lawmakers say about that?
Our goal is always to at least be transparent in how we came to our conclusions. Obviously, a statement that comes down with a false or mostly false or a pants on fire kind of rating, we're not going to get a great reaction from the people that we're fact checking. But our goal is to be just really upfront in what our sources are, where we've gotten the background, the information, and ultimately how we've broken down the claim. That's really kind of the core element of what we do, is that, you know, we're not writing any kind of a comprehensive treatise on red flag laws, for example. What we're doing is looking at one specific sentence or two and saying, okay, is this an accurate description of what's going on right now, an accurate description of this topic? Is the context that they used it in a fair way to refer to this? So it's a way to kind of give some background on a topic as a way of better understanding it. But ultimately, we're dealing with how one particular person has phrased it. So a lot of the pushback that we get tends to be from people who just see us as, you know, maybe not coming down on their side of the political aisle. But really, it's about how that particular phrase treated an issue.
We have less than a minute left, but I want to make sure we get in whether Governor Tony Evers has fulfilled his campaign pledges and promises. Have you found a place where the governor has fallen short?
So there has been a few of these. As we did with Scott Walker before him, we were looking at a series of promises that Governor Evers has made. One of the highest profile ones that we found has not been kept was a last minute campaign pledge that he made to raise no taxes. This showed up late in the campaign, said it in a couple different venues. And this is one of those things where it's important to note that we rate outcomes and not intent.
All right. And Eric, I'm sorry, we'll have to leave it right there. Eric Liedtke is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and PolitiFact Wisconsin. We'll make sure to have him back. We've been talking about how state leaders are talking about gun control and whether their statements are rooted in fact. We'll get the latest breakdown from a Wisconsin public radio reporter next as the state capitol report continues after the news. I'm Keely Boltina. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're catching up on all of Wisconsin's political news as we start this week. Top of the list is a special session on gun safety. The governor called lawmakers to address gun control, and members of the state legislature, they convened for less than 1 minute. Here's an excerpt.
The hour of 2 p.m. on November 7th, having arrived, the Assembly is in special session. Gentlemen from the 5th.
Mr. Speaker, I move the Assembly stand adjourned pursuant to SJR 1.
It's a non-debatable motion. All in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. The Assembly is adjourned pursuant to SJR 1.
So what do you think about gun policy in our state? What's your take on expanded background checks or red flag laws? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Do you agree with the way Wisconsin politicians are handling the discussion about gun policy? Do you think bipartisan gun policy is even possible right now? You can email us at ideas@WPR or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She's also co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, thanks for being here on the Ideas Network.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You know, we had these special sessions on gun control, but they were really special sessions, like only in name. No votes, no debate. Mm-hmm. What happened here?
So basically what was going on was there were two proposals that the governor had called on lawmakers to take up. These are proposals that had been kind of in the ether of, you know, the conversation at the Capitol for several weeks now. Republican lawmakers knew what they were. They were a proposal to expand background checks on gun sales in Wisconsin to private sales. Some of those sales are at gun shows. And also a red flag law, which is a provision that allows people to have their gun rights temporarily revoked if a friend or family member flags them as potentially dangerous to themselves or others. So Republican lawmakers said, we really don't like these proposals. We think they violate Second Amendment and due process rights. We're not going to vote on them. We have such a profound disagreement with these things that the governor is calling for that we're not even going to really convene and come to the floor for this special session. We're just going to, as they say in kind of capital parlance, gavel in and gavel out.
Right, with no real substance in between. We knew this, though. I mean, Republicans said in advance they were not going to debate. They were not going to hold votes during this special session. The governor and other Democrats criticized those decisions. Here's State Senator Lena Taylor of Milwaukee.
I'm all for a little debate and disagreement, but you got to show up to work. You got to show up and defend the position.
So, Laurel, why didn't Republicans bring their own bills to the table or have any sort of open debate on the floor? What's their stance?
So Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said that his caucus wasn't able to come up with anything related to guns in Wisconsin that they agreed on that they wanted to take up as part of the special session. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Republican leadership in the Assembly had a slightly different tack. They say that they have some mental health proposals that they want to take up at a later date. They're still kind of working on those. They also said that the legislation that they took up during their regular session on the day that the special session was called, in their belief, sort of address the root causes of gun violence better than they believe the governor's proposals would have. They voted on things like state funding for suicide prevention grants. They talked about, you know, the prevalence of firearms in suicide deaths in Wisconsin. And they also tried to take up a couple, or three rather, veto overrides that had to do with mental health funding in Wisconsin. So they said they were addressing the issue just in a little bit of a different way than the governor wanted to.
We'll dig into those in just a few minutes. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, also co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. And right now we're talking about gun safety, and we'll also discuss the governor's veto of funding for a mental health crisis center in northern Wisconsin, moving that funding to Madison. You can weigh in, 800-642-1234. Are you listening in northern Wisconsin? Do you agree with the move? Regardless of where you are in our state, what are mental health needs in your area? 800-642-1234. Sticking with guns, though, Laurel, recent Marquette University Law School polls have found a majority of Wisconsinites support red flag laws and these universal background checks. So how does that issue of public opinion factor into the decisions Republican leaders are making?
So Republican leaders say that these public opinion polls are you know, essentially kind of one indicator of where some individuals might be on the issue, but they believe that they have the true pulse of their constituents. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said, you know, I've been traveling around my district quite a lot. Some people who are really tapped into politics in Wisconsin might be aware that Senator Fitzgerald is actually running for Congress now, the seat being vacated by Congressman Sensenbrenner. And so he's spending a lot of time on the ground in that area where he's also a state senator. And he says, you know, people are very concerned about protecting Second Amendment rights. And so that's the vote that I'm taking. So I think kind of the disconnect between the Democratic argument of, hey, look, these proposals have 80% support among the public. Republicans are saying, well, it's just a poll. I know what my constituents want, and I'm also going to vote with the beliefs that I have that I campaigned on.
Kevin from Viroqua has an opinion on this. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me. So good morning, guys. My thought here is that from previous mass shootings in the past, there have been family members that have been worried about someone who's then going and carried out an atrocity, and even law enforcement who have been watching someone and they've still had that ability to go out and take the life of others through maybe mental health. So how can this be a bad thing? How can anyone think it would be a bad thing that someone who is mentally unstable shouldn't be able to have a firearm and potentially take the life of an innocent person?
Kevin, thanks for the question. And Laurel, does it all tie back to the Constitution?
Yeah. So, I mean, Republican lawmakers are really pointing to Second Amendment and due process protections, and they just believe that these proposals go too far. The red flag law in particular, you know, there is a petition process where a family member flags someone as potentially dangerous to themselves or others. It goes to a judge. The judge then decides about the temporary revocation of those gun rights. But they said that the process isn't suitable to them because they feel like, you know, someone's flagged, then they're contacted by a court. They didn't know that that was going to happen. There isn't sufficient really notice for that person. They just don't like how that plays out. For the background checks, they also feel that that's just an undue burden for these private sales, kind of getting government involved where they don't believe it should be.
When we're talking about broader gun policy, in the past, we've seen state Republicans advocating for increased security measures, places like schools or the state Capitol building. Is that still a strategy they want to see?
Well, that was something that particularly Assembly Republicans were talking about several weeks ago. You know, when the governor first talked about calling this special session, this was really quite a bit of time in the making. You know, he called for these proposals. He said, let's have the debate on these. Let's talk about these. He kind of delayed calling the special session. He wanted Republicans to kind of move on their own. But part of that conversation was initially, what do Republicans want to do? And it was mental health funding, and it was increased funding for security for places like schools, maybe some government buildings. They're called soft targets in these conversations. So that was something that was talked about several weeks ago, not something that we've heard too much about in recent days, and definitely not something that came up during the actual special session day last week.
I know you're a reporter, but if you're looking into your crystal ball, you spend a lot of time at the Capitol. Do you think we're likely to see bipartisan policy here? I mean, can they figure it out together when they're on such completely different sides?
Well, you know, that's what that's really what Assembly Speaker Voss and Senator Fitzgerald were calling the governor out on last week. They said that the governor knew that the two proposals he put forward weren't going to have sufficient support in the Republican-controlled legislature. So they said it was kind of disingenuous on the part of the governor to say that these were things that could move forward. He needed to be a little bit more realistic, kind of come to the table and figure out something that was bipartisan that everybody could agree on. Now, on the other side of the token, the governor said you weren't even engaging in debate on these issues. So how can we change them and make them more palatable? How can we do things that are more in line with what both parties want if we're not even having this debate? So I think that's kind of step one if we're going to get to kind of a policy that everybody can agree on.
Let's bring on Steve from Sun Prairie now. Steve, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the things I was disappointed in with the Republicans is, you know, I think it's a common sense solution that's out there, and that's what you just talked about, these soft targets. It would have been nice if they had the ability, and maybe they didn't, was to have debate on decreasing school funding for any school that doesn't allow concealed carry, so we don't have kids sitting there as sitting ducks to be killed. Did they have the option to do that, or did they only have to debate what Evers put in front of them?
Steve, thanks for the question. Is this something that was even an option for them to think about, Laurel?
So as far as I know, where concealed carry is concerned, there aren't any proposed changes in the Capitol or any, you know, any measures that they're really considering with that, other than a so-called universal carry situation where you wouldn't have to pass any class, get that concealed carry permit. You would just be able to concealed carry without any additional regulation. Right.
It's so, an assumed right
exactly.
That you have the right to conceal carry unless exactly. It is revoked.
Exactly. So that's something that Republican lawmakers have talked about in the past, but hasn't come up in a big way yet this session. So we'll have to keep an eye on that.
We've been talking about how members of Wisconsin state legislature are handling gun policy or how they're choosing not to deal with it right now. And we'll be moving on to talk more about mental health support in Wisconsin. The two are certainly connected as we see lawmakers trying to figure out how to prevent suicide and encourage people to get help that they need. Find access. Your thoughts are welcome. 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin works enough to prevent suicide? Are you watching what's happening on the Suicide Prevention Task Force? Where should our priorities lie? What can we do about it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the State Capitol Report. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about how lawmakers are trying to provide better mental health service in Wisconsin. That includes adding positions to create a suicide prevention program, requiring doctors and social workers to take continuing education on preventing suicide if they're renewing their license for the first time. And we want to hear from you. What do you think state leaders can do to improve mental health in our state? Whose responsibility is it to make sure people have access to these life-saving services? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Laurel White stays with us. She is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Reporter.
Laurel, Republicans in the legislature tried to override three of the governor's vetoes, and they actually related to mental health. They did fail to override them. But the first of those vetoes takes $15 million in funding that was supposed to go to a mental health crisis center in northern Wisconsin and puts that into a facility in Madison. Why is the governor shifting funding here?
So in his veto message, the governor said that he believed the youth in need of mental health services in Wisconsin would continue to be served by this expansion of the Madison facility. So basically what would happen under the governor's budget veto, which is still in place, the veto override didn't work, as you mentioned, the $15 million that was going to go for this proposed facility in northern Wisconsin was just shifted to an expansion of the Mendota Mental Health Center. So additional beds in that facility, more resources for individuals under 18 who need that kind of support. Now, kind of the pushback on that from Republican lawmakers is that, for example, if someone is in Superior and needs these kind of services, they have kind of a long trip. You know, an 11-hour round trip is what Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke cited. And he said, that's really not acceptable. We need these kind of resources in northern Wisconsin. So Republicans were really pushing their Democratic colleagues from that part of the state to join them in this veto override, but they weren't successful.
Could the state still put forward funding for a mental health center in northern Wisconsin, even though it's going to Madison for now?
Absolutely. So this is actually something that's in the works. A number of lawmakers are working on drafting a bill that would revive this funding for the northern Wisconsin facility. And that's something that the Assembly Majority Leader acknowledged on that the day of the veto overrides. He said, you know, I know people are working on this. This isn't something that's going to go away. But it would be the quickest and easiest way to get moving on this project to just go ahead and do the veto override now.
Let's go to the phones now. Kevin in Ozaukee is calling with a question. Kevin, thanks for being here on the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you. My wife, she deals with depression, but she's being medicated for it and stuff. And she's wondering, is that going to red flag her for purchasing a gun or anything?
Okay. Thanks, Kevin. And Laurel, red flag, different situation with the red flag laws. Mm-hmm. So that necessarily isn't the way we might phrase what would happen. But if someone is being treated for depression, we know that these mental health bills in the legislature are connected to gun policy. Mm-hmm. What can we discern here?
So as far as I know, and I'm certainly not an expert in the intricacies of these gun laws, but I don't believe that receiving medical care for any mental health condition is enough to flag you in the system. I think, you know, for background check purposes, obviously, if you've committed a crime, you know, you're flagged during the background check process. For the red flag laws, these are just things that if a friend or family member contacts law enforcement and says, I'm really worried about this person having a firearm, you know, and then the kind of the process rolls from there in terms of the judge hearing the arguments from the family member, decides whether a temporary revocation of gun rights is appropriate in that instance. But that process would not happen unless a family member or a friend or a coworker or someone who knows that person very well goes to law enforcement and kind of, you know, in the words of the bill, kind of raises that flag.
Sure. Right? Presumably there's some sort of emergency or acute situation mm-hmm. where they would notice that, not an underlying long-term challenge unless
exactly.
there was a concern. All right. Let's also go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, what are your thoughts about funding with mental health across Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, judges are the only ones that can issue an order for somebody to go into treatment. So it should be up to the judge. Secondly, it should be you should be funding all the crisis lines in Wisconsin. And thirdly, community-based social service agencies, because they do wonderful things for people. They help them get jobs, education, apartments, entertainment. And that's my opinion.
All right. Thanks, Mary Kay. Laurel, are we seeing a push for more community-based services or mm-hmm. focuses through the state legislature and with Wisconsin leaders?
So particularly as it relates to suicide prevention and programming, there was a really big push last week to put more state funds behind some of these community-based programs to get more money to community organizations to do that kind of work. In terms of, additional mental health funding for some of those entities, you know, that's something that the legislature has certainly been focusing on as well, and the governor has set as a priority. So I think we're moving in that direction.
One of Evers' vetoes that the legislature did not override is that it eliminated the legislature's oversight of additional state funding for Medicaid reimbursements. Mm-hmm. Help us understand that.
So this is a really wonky change. So what's going on there is that the Joint Finance Committee, the State Budget Writing Committee, which is currently controlled by Republicans, had given itself authority over a statewide increase in Medicaid reimbursements each year. They wanted to be able to approve those increases through that body. This is something that we've seen in a number of other areas, kind of the Joint Finance Committee taking additional oversight over certain funds. We heard about it actually when we talked a lot about a farmer suicide prevention program earlier this year. That was something that had been approved in the budget, but the funding was held up because the Finance Committee hadn't given it that second layer of approval. So what would happen with these Medicaid reimbursements is that the governor took away that additional Finance Committee oversight and just gave it back to the Department of Health Services. So just a little bit of shifting in who's in charge of this money. Now, I did reach out to the governor's office and ask whether they were moving forward within DHS with those increases and didn't get a response. So, but that was the plan.
More of that jockeying back and forth. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, and we're discussing mental health proposals. And we're also talking about the fact that the legislature rejected a cabinet pick by Governor Tony Evers. The state Senate voted to fire Brad Paff, Evers' pick to run the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He'd been in the office almost a year now. Why did the Senate fire him?
So it actually goes back to that farmer suicide prevention program. So PATH had really strongly pushed back on Republican lawmakers about that delay in funding. He pointed out that he only had enough money for 5 mental health care vouchers to give out to farmers at the point of, you know, where the delay in funding was. And he said to Republican lawmakers, you know, which 5 farmers are we going to help? Which 5 farmers do you want to pick? Which individuals are going to get these services? And they really disagreed with his framing of the issue in that way. They said it was disrespectful. They said they didn't really like his tone. And so that kind of set a adversarial relationship between PATH and Republican lawmakers. They've cited a couple other things that they didn't like in terms of how he was doing the job, a proposed rule that would change manure storage regulation for large farms. So this was a really kind of public and decisive way to say, we really don't agree with this leadership and we're going to go ahead and take the step and remove him from this position.
And the state Senate also voted to limit the governor's veto power. Wisconsin governors have pretty extensive veto powers compared to the rest of the country. What's the Senate proposing?
So this would be actually a constitutional amendment. So this would be a pretty big change. It would bar the governor from using his veto pen to increase state spending in any way. So this is a very early part of this constitutional amendment process. It has to pass both chambers of the state legislature in 2 consecutive legislative sessions, and then it has to go to a statewide voter referendum before any constitutional amendment can, take effect. So this was the very first vote on that plan. It hasn't been heard in the assembly, and it would have to come back next session. So this is something we'll be talking about for a while.
And what happened with the vote in the state Senate?
It did pass, so it's on its way.
All right. Laurel, thank you so much for being here with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She also co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. This has been the State Capitol Report. Just ahead, a major book publisher recently placed new limits on the sales of e-books to public libraries, and we understand why that matters and what it means for readers. I'm Keeley Boltina. Kate Archer-Kent is back tomorrow. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.